Call the Senate Tax Committee to order. Welcome back, members. I hope, I thought it was a pretty easy interim on the Tax Committee in that I don't, we certainly didn't have the work burden that the transportation or the healthcare people had, but, or the bonding committee. I'm hoping our Republican members didn't quit on us.
Does it matter?
I don't see any of them. I don't see any of them here yet today.
They were having a caucus.
Oh, okay. So I don't know if they have any new staff. They're going to be with the committee this year yet because I haven't had an opportunity to talk to them. But we do have one new staff for the Senate committee this year, Josh. We have a new committee page this year. Josh, why don't you come up and tell people a little something about yourself? He's got a degree in political science, so he can. This is his test.
I'm Josh. I'm Senator Bach and Senator Vickerman and Senator Scoy's new committee page, and I graduated from Gustavus in May 2007.
And from home?
From Hastings, Minnesota.
Thank you. Committee members, there is underneath your agenda for today, you'll see some important dates for our committee work this year, so take a look at that. And I got a couple other things I want to comment on, but maybe we'll wait till the Republican members come. So maybe we'll get started with the committee's agenda today. We have two reports from the legislative auditor, the Job Z report, which came out about a week ago, and the misclassification of employees as independent contractors. So which one would the office like to start with?
Misclassification, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Deborah Parker-Janod with the Legislative Auditor's Office, here to give you an overview of our evaluation report on misclassification of employees as independent contractors. My presentation this morning, I'll go over what misclassification is, how big a problem it is in Minnesota, why it matters, and what the state has been doing about it. First, let me start with an overview. We estimated that about 14% of employers misclassified at least one worker in 2005. Overall, a relatively small proportion of workers were misclassified. Negative impacts of misclassification are felt broadly by workers, employers, and government. And finally, we found that the state's response is fragmented and limited in scope. Let me start with how worker classification is determined. Workers come in different types. There are employees like me. I'm an employee of the state of Minnesota. And there are independent contractors who are self-employed individuals, among other types of classification. But today we'll focus on employees and independent contractors. The distinction between those two is not an option to be agreed upon. Neither an employer nor a worker can simply choose that I want to be an employee or an independent contractor. Classification depends on criteria that are established in law, rule, and cases. Factors include such things as the degree of control over when, where, and how work is performed, the employer's ability to discharge a worker without liability, the method with which the worker is paid, and who furnishes the materials and tools. In addition, Minnesota state law includes some specific criteria, a set of nine, that define an independent contractor in the construction industry. Let me give you a couple of examples from IRS guidance to illustrate these distinctions. Take, for example, Sarah. She is a tile setter who works with a builder full-time but at various different construction sites. She uses her own tools. She works in the order determined by the employer. She's paid on a piecework basis but does not perform similar work for other builders or employers. Sarah is an employee. She should be paid on a W-2 wage and tax statement, and that wage and tax information would be sent to the Internal Revenue Service and eventually to the state of Minnesota. Elizabeth is a tile setter. She has a signed contract with a builder to do tile work for a housing complex. She's paid a flat amount for all services rendered. She carries her own workers' compensation insurance and is responsible for repairs if there's a problem with the work that's been done. Elizabeth is an independent contractor. Her wages, or not wages, her income would be reported on a Form 1099 MIS. So employees' wages are reported to the IRS on a W-2. Independent contractors are reported on Form 1099. How big a problem is misclassification? We estimated that one in seven employers who are enrolled in Minnesota's unemployment insurance system, one in seven misclassified at least one worker in 2005. Again, these data are based on audit information from the Department of Employment and Economic Development, DEED. They have the most systematic audit program that allows us to gather information about the extent of misclassification. So using those data, about one in seven employers in 2005 misclassified. Overall, they misclassified a relatively small proportion of their employees. About 1% of all employers audited, about 6% of employees among those found to have misclassified. We found that misclassification occurs in many industries. The construction industry is generally well known to have an issue with misclassification, but the data show that it's also prevalent in other industries, including retail trade, entertainment, healthcare. We found that some misclassification is intentional. For example, in one case, there's a builder who had employee work crews building on construction sites 1 month. Another month, the same supervisor and work crews had been spun off as independent contractors. Clearly an intentional change in status of those workers. I would also like to point out that our estimates are conservative. Again, we based our numbers, our estimates, on the audit program from DEED, but that to the extent that employers are not registered for the unemployment system but should be, our numbers will be underestimates. In addition, we did not pick up misclassification that would occur in the cash economy. That could be a fairly extensive and significant problem as well, but we just weren't able to pick it up in our data. Why does it matter? There are many, many legal obligations and programs that are linked directly to employee status. For example, unemployment insurance, workers' compensation, various income tax laws, Social Security and Medicare, fair labor standards, occupational safety and health. These are all linked directly to the existence of an employer-employee relationship as it's defined in law. For independent contractors, those obligations generally do not apply. So there are, in fact, important implications in terms of bypassing obligations linked to employment, and therein lies one of the key motivations to misclassify workers. But there are also tax implications. Obligations related to unemployment insurance taxes and obligations related to employer withholding of wages from employees' income are also linked to employee status. It's a particular issue, I think, with income tax withholding in this state. Withholding is linked to very high tax compliance among wage earners. The IRS estimates that wage and salary earners report 99% of their income voluntarily on tax returns. Generally speaking, the tax compliance among the self-employed is much lower, reporting generally as a group 43% of their income voluntarily. So to the extent that we have workers in Minnesota who should be treated as employees and should be subject to employee withholding, there are strong tax implications for us as a state, and we have a high motivation ourselves to ensure that employees are properly classified.
Mr. Knott, in your investigation, is there any way for us to track delinquent child support payments, obligations with independent 1099 independent contractors? I mean, I've personally run into that in my job outside of the legislature for the Carpenters Union, where I've run into people working on a small storefront, and you go try to sell them an idea of getting, you know, some benefits, some pension and health benefits, and And I've frequently heard people say, well, gee, I can't go on somebody's payroll because I'm so far in child support, I'll never see a check. And I just kind of wonder if is there any mechanism in place where revenue works with human services somehow to track delinquent child support with people's ability to be able to avoid garnishing their wages by working as independent contractors. Is there any mechanism in place?
Mr. Chair, I'm not positive. I believe there is a relationship between the Department of Revenue and Human Services. I'm not sure how that's linked to W-2 wage reporting versus 1099 income reporting. I'd need to do a little investigation to get back to you.
And maybe I'll ask the commissioner
There's
a little bit later, maybe.
From the Department of Revenue here as well who could provide a more accurate and specific answer.
I think you'll have an answer before today is over.
Great.
Thank you. Continue, please.
Misclassification also puts compliant employers at a competitive disadvantage. There are important fairness issues about level playing field for employers. We ran a simple example about what would happen for a drywall installer or a business that is employing drywall installers. And if that employer accurately classifies workers as employees and paid a base wage of $30 an hour, that employer would also have obligations totaling another $7.82 for unemployment insurance tax obligations, Social Security, and workers' compensation premiums. If that employer were to misclassify workers as independent contractors, that employer would bypass those obligations and continue to pay just an hourly rate of $30 an hour. That's a 26% difference in labor cost. If you applied that to a typical job that would take 175 hours for installing drywall in a new home, that would total up to about $6,600 in labor costs for the compliant employer and $5,200 for the employer who misclassified employees. Again, that's a 26% difference. Let me move on to how the state deals with issues of misclassification. Authority is divided among three different agencies depending on the program that is involved. DEED, as I said, is the administrative agency for the unemployment insurance system. It has guidance related to misclassification and classification of workers in Minnesota statutes, in the department's rules, and also in case law surrounding unemployment insurance. The Department of Labor and Industry has obligations related to the Workers' Compensation Program, Fair Labor Standards, and Occupational Safety and Health. They also have guidance related to worker classification in three chapters of Minnesota statutes, their rules, and relevant case law in those areas. And finally, the Department of Revenue has a role to play with classification. They are particularly interested in the context of income tax and income tax withholding. And because Minnesota's income tax system is linked with the federal income tax system, our Department of Revenue's guidance related to classification is from the Internal Revenue Service, and they make sure that their actions here in Minnesota are comparable to what the federal government does. So in spite of all of these different elements of guidance and law and rule involved in classification, it's important to remember that the decision-making factors or the criteria that determine whether a worker is an employee or an independent contractor, there are more similarities than there are differences in the guidance that the three agencies use. Let me talk a little bit about enforcement. We went to each of the agencies and did some work about how they identify and deal with misclassification. In general, at all three agencies, identifying and correcting misclassification happens as a byproduct of their administration of other programs. For example, at DEED, they will look for misclassification in their audits of unemployment insurance compensation compliance or in their investigations of claims. We found that the level of effort among the three agencies differed, ranged from more limited to modest enforcement actions. As I said, DEED They audit about 2% of employers registered for the unemployment insurance system each year. That is the most systematic means for identifying misclassification in the state. They also would investigate misclassification as part of their investigations and benefit claims, where an individual has files a claim about unemployment insurance benefits. The Department of Revenue has a new audit program. It's run out of their withholding division. They started that in, I believe, 2006. At the time we were doing our work last summer, they had completed 37 audits. And in among those, 24, they found misclassification in 24. That's about 65% of the audits that they completed. From those, they determined that employers should have withheld $600,000 in income tax from wages. So it's a, obviously, those are productive audits. Those audits had not gone through the process far enough to know how much of that money actually came in to the state, but they did identify additional obligations to the tune of $600,000. Department of Labor and Industry generally identifies misclassification on a complaint basis. They don't have a systematic audit program that would get at this issue, but they will investigate classification issues if there's a complaint about workers' compensation or labor laws and classification's an issue. We found that the departments generally did not share information among themselves about instances of misclassification, about those employees or the employers that were involved, and we found little coordination of enforcement strategies among the three. Another issue, there are no specific penalties in state law for misclassifying workers. There are penalties that would come into play and do come into play if the misclassification causes a program violation. For example, if an employer fails to have workers' compensation insurance because that employer has erroneously classified all of its workers as independent contractors, that misclassification, if identified, would trigger a penalty for failure to have workers' compensation insurance. Similarly, in unemployment insurance, if an employer has misclassified a group of 10 employees or 10 workers and doesn't pay unemployment insurance tax, they can be penalized for that failure to pay unemployment insurance tax. But there is no specific statement in state law that says it is illegal to misclassify workers. The legislature did pass a new law that will go into effect in 2009, and it is related to independent contractor status in the construction industry. In essence, it requires those workers who want to operate as independent contractors in construction to go to the Department of Labor and Industry to get a certificate that says that they are capable of functioning as an independent contractor. That's not enough to actually achieve that status in any given employment situation. So a construction worker needs to have that certificate, but then the circumstances of work also need to meet the 9 criteria. That law again comes into play in 2009, so we have no information yet about the impact that it will have on issues of misclassification in the state.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Clay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the enforcement issue, how does that tie in with the workers' comp insurance audits that businesses go through? Does that play into that enforcement? Because isn't that how a lot of misclassification would be picked up?
If there were a complaint about coverage or in the labor and industry's investigation of workers' compensation, yes, misclassification would be found. If we did not get into any work or investigation that would be done by the insurance carriers who provide workers' compensation, but they obviously have an interest in proper classification as well because the premiums are linked to those who are classified as employees.
And, Mr. Chair, from my recollection, that would be the way that most of this would be picked up because they're auditing those payrolls, every year or every other year, aren't they?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sko, the most systematic audit program in Minnesota is the Unemployment Insurance Audit Program, and that's they pick up, as we said, we estimated that about 14% of employers misclassify, and those instances of misclassification would be picked up there. The Department of Labor and Industry doesn't have a similar systematic audit program for workers' compensation.
Continue, please.
Let me just close with the recommendations. We recommended that the three agencies get together and standardize criteria that are used for classification, again, in hopes that that would facilitate then information sharing among the three, particularly on the facts and circumstances of cases. There may be nuances and instances where, you know, each would need to make a specific determination in their areas of law, but we do think there's an advantage in, to the fullest extent possible, standardizing the criteria used to distinguish between employees and independent contractors. We recommend that they establish information sharing procedures and coordinate their enforcement programs. And finally, we think the legislature should consider authorizing a penalty in law for repeated instances of misclassification. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. And I believe, is Senator Metzen's committee going to hear this report also?
Yes, Mr. Chair, tomorrow.
Anything else, members?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Job Z.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pokemon.
Are we going to hear from the agencies
on this? Well, it might be easier to do it. That's a good point, Senator Pokemon. It might be easier to do it after the report rather than at the end. Let's do it right now.
Okay. Great. Good morning, Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Ward Ines, representing the Department of Revenue.
And I'm Dan McElroy, representing the Department of Employment and Economic Development.
Well, first and foremost, I think we want to commend Legislative Auditor for the work on this report. It flagged some issues for us that I think needed to be on our radar screen. And we concur with the recommendations. We've worked diligently since the issuance of the report to try to do what we can administratively to adopt the recommendations. In the Department of Revenue, we have a very strong belief that if you're not compliant in one tax type, you're probably not compliant in another tax type. So we do the best within our agency to share that information. We haven't done as good a job between agencies sharing that information. Well, the first thing we did in response to this Legislative Auditor's Report was get our data practices folks together and make sure that we could share the information without running afoul of any data practices laws or anything like that. We had all those folks in the room. We came to the conclusion that there weren't any impediments in current law to sharing this information and trying to track the non-compliant employers and businesses. And so in light of that, we've adopted some new protocols to share additional information. I think BEAT and Revenue now are sharing information about non-compliant taxpayers. We may flag somebody at DEED in the unemployment insurance area. They send that over to our withholding division. And we're getting better flow of information between agencies. You know, we're guilty of a lot of businesses. We get siloed. And we operate in our own little world and revenue. And you got to realize that there's ramifications. We don't communicate with our other agencies. So we're doing a better job on that front. Also, there's the uniformity of definitions between what independent contractor is an issue. And I know, Chairman, we've talked about this at a couple of different occasions. And right now, the biggest impediment to having a uniform definition between all three agencies is the Department of Revenue. Because we conform with the feds. And the feds have a provision called the 530 Safe Harbor. And as long as we conform to that definition, that's a function of legislation. We need legislation to not conform with that definition. There's going to be a wrinkle between how we identify an independent contractor and the other agencies. So we've talked, Chairman, you about that. It's something we're worth considering, I think, and we should look into that and maybe pursue that potentially. Another thing I think to touch on is Legislative Auditor mentioned. Withholding is the real, I think, remedy to a lot of this. And we have not been shy as an agency of coming forward to this committee and asking for enhanced, you know, withholding requirements. As you know, Chairman, we've had that 2% withholding proposal in front of your committee for a year now. In fact, we've introduced it 3 consecutive years. Hopefully we can get that. That's a legislative proposal that really has identified an area of high noncompliance in the construction industry. We think that 2% withholding would go a long ways towards addressing that issue. We're going to be coming forward this legislative session with another one called backup withholding. And basically how this will work is if the IRS tells an employer that they've identified a false SS number, they'll be required to implement backup withholding. It'll be mandated. And so anytime we get a bad SS number, we'll communicate that to the employer, and they'll be required to implement backup withholding. So we constantly think about how to address this issue, breach this hole, and we'd be happy to hear any more of the recommendations. But we really embrace the findings of the report, and we look forward to working with you to try to address it best we can.
Commissioner, those 37 audits that you did, how did you identify that sample of independent contractors to audit?
Yeah, you know,
or employers?
That's a good question. I don't have a very good answer for you. We've done a little bit more than 40 now. We're also implementing an audit tracking system, which will give us better information about where we should dedicate our resources. Because one issue with every agency is that we have a limited amount of resources, and we have a limited number of auditors we can employ. And so this audit tracking system will really help us identify, will flag certain indicators, help us better identify which employers to audit so we're not wasting time on no-change audits. I think the fact that 60% of the people we audited in that first round, that audit pool, were non-compliant shows we're doing a pretty good job of identifying who was out of compliance or potentially out of compliance. The more flags we have, the more indicators, the better job we'll do at kind of mining the most productive audits. But, Chairman, I'd be happy to get an answer for you on that, because I'm not exactly sure how we flagged that particular pool, but it proved to be a pretty productive audit pool.
Right. And is there, to my earlier question, let's take, for example, those 24 out of 37 you phoned with non-compliance issues. Is there any information sharing between revenue and human services, whether those same people have delinquent child support obligations?
First and foremost, I clarify that we no longer do child support collections on behalf of DHS. We severed that relationship before I came on board, but that's, I don't know all the history there, but we no longer collect on behalf of DHS for child support. So I don't have a good answer on that, but you know, it is a function of our collection division, and the collection division will look at 1099 sources in order for garnishment or going after putting a tax lien in place. So we're very diligent about trying to identify all the potential sources to attach a tax levy. But with respect to DHS, we don't have a relationship with regard to child support. And they have a unique mechanism over there that allows them to actually send delinquent child support individuals, their social security numbers and the like, to banks, and banks are able to match if there's an account in that at that institution. So they have a very strong mechanism that was required by federal law that they have a very high success rate at getting those child support payments satisfied just because they have this bank match mechanism that really, really gives them ideal information.
Mr. McElroy, something?
I do have a few things to add. Mr. Chairman, and I join Commissioner Ines in thanking Legislative Auditor. We agree with the report. And a fair amount has happened already in response to the report. First of all, to put some numbers to the information Deborah provided about the scope of the audits we do. The department has 34 people that do unemployment insurance audits. We audit about 2,300 companies a year. Misclassification is on the at the top of the list of things that we are looking for. We have, since this report was brought to our attention, we have made two exchanges with revenue. The first was 40 independent contractors that we believe there was probable cause, maybe employees that we've provided to their withholding division. The second was 10 employers with multiple employees, in one case a large number of employees, that we made the change for unemployment to reclassify people from unemployment from independent contractors to employees, and brought those employers and employees to the attention of revenue just in the last week or two. So it's beginning to work. There are, however, the four issues that are identified by the auditor, we agree with Commissioner Ines, need some attention. We would recommend that the legislature give revenue the authority not to recognize the safe harbor provision. As I understand the safe harbor, it essentially says that if in good faith a employer was treating people as independent contractors prior to a particular date, they have the authority to continue doing so, and it makes it enforcement difficult. we would like to use, or think it would be good policy to use the same IRS definition across the three agencies. We also, there is some special law exceptions in construction and trucking that have been, that are identical between Dolly and Deed, but do not apply at the Department of Revenue. And it would be, we think, prudent to consider that. We agree with Revenue that there aren't any data practices or restraints that we're aware of. If some come up, we'll bring those to your attention. One issue we have some concerns about is the issue of further penalties. It is already a felony to underreport unemployment insurance, to intentionally underpay unemployment insurance. There is also a private right of action available to employers or independent contractors who believe they've been misclassified intentionally. We have not, in recent memory, used the authority to make a report to a county attorney. We are. I have asked our staff to keep that authority very much in mind. And if we find a case of intentional misclassification resulting in underpayment, we will be taking it to county attorneys. So it's certainly an issue that this department should, or that this committee may want to consider, but there are some penalty provisions already in law. Thank you.
Senator Pogomar.
Noticing the response, commissioners, that the characterization of the audit that efforts to detect and correct misclassification reflect the resource challenges of each agency. Does that mean you don't have enough money to do your job?
Probably separate answers to the two departments because they're funded in different ways. I can start on the unemployment insurance side. I think we do get enough money, Senator. Our Unemployment Insurance Administration is funded by the federal unemployment tax, the FUTA tax. It is an annual allocation from the Department of Labor. We have to manage how we allocate it, but we will manage that as aggressively as we can. I think we're okay on the administrative grant side for unemployment.
Yeah, Chairman, Senator Pogomiller, and I would concur with Commissioner McElroy on that. I mean, it's a zero-sum game in any state budget. Any agency is a zero-sum game. You put an auditor in one area, it detracts from a different area. So we're always making those priority decisions. And I think we are unique in one respect, is that we do have an obligation to the legislature to meet our compliance objectives. And so we are stretched, and that really, to a large extent, is one of our primary goals. This is part of that effort. But we also are very cognizant that we have to go where the revenue dollars are. I mean, you have tasked us with collecting over $100 million over the next biennium. We advise this agency or this committee that's a stretch goal for us. And so we have deployed most of our auditors in areas where we think we can generate the most revenue. And this may or may not be that area. We're always looking. We have 5 auditors right now in the withholding division to cover the whole gamut. We're always looking at, deploying more auditors in that area. But it is a challenge for our agency. It is a challenge for our agency. I've redeployed some folks to the taxpayer assistance area because I think we've gotten too lean in that area. We're doing more audits. We're doing more compliance. As a result, you get more taxpayer complaints. You get more things that your taxpayer advocate has to work on. So we're constantly reevaluating, Senator, where our resources are going to yield the greatest benefit. But this is not an area we are going to neglect. Dan Lee, head of our withholding, it's prominently on his radar screen for attention, and we've had multiple meetings since this report was issued to address this issue.
Senator Pogomar.
So I guess I'm a little confused. There were 3 agencies that signed this, so does that mean labor and industry doesn't have enough money? I mean, I'm reading directly from the agency letter to the auditor in response to this, and it says the agencies, presumably the 3, agree with the findings, and then it says... Basically, it says reflects the resource challenge each of our agencies face. I mean, but you just said you have enough resources. So is this letter incorrect? Do you have enough resources or don't you?
Can I respond first?
You can respond first. And then I can respond.
Because I am reading this right from the letter.
Yes, you are.
That is signed by yourself, by 3 commissioners.
Exactly.
I thought when I read that you were saying you didn't have enough resources, but now you tell us you do have enough resources.
Chairman, Senator Fogelmiller, in an ideal world, if we could put 100 people on the misclassification of employees, we would do that. In an ideal world, if we had 100 auditors to free up, and we could put them all on the misclassification of employees, that would be a good thing, and we would go a long ways toward addressing this issue. The reality is we don't have 100 FT auditors to deploy in this area, so we do the best we can with the resources we have. We have adequate resources to, I think, give us the attention it warrants. But with every decision we make within the confines of the agency, there's challenges, and there's, you know, and so we're going to do everything we possibly can to address this issue and implement the findings.
So, Commissioner?
Yep.
So you have enough resources to address it to the extent it's warranted. So you think minimal to modest is the extent it's warranted? Because that's what the auditor says, that there's a minimal to modest enforcement here.
It was a minimal modest enforcement prior to this report. I agree. We did not probably have the protocols in place. I think the most important thing that will come out of this report is the exchange of information between the different agencies. And that's something we should have been doing in the future, in the past. We're definitely going to do it in the future. That's not a huge resource challenge, just exchanging information, making sure when we flag an out-of-compliant taxpayer, we share that information with Commissioner McElroy's agency. That's something that's not, you know.
David, Commissioner?
Pardon me?
But, Commissioner, that's not what the letter says. The letter says it's a resource challenge. So I'm just trying to find out if it is or isn't. And you're testifying today that the letter is not correct, that it's not a resource challenge. It was a commitment challenge.
Commissioner McElroy.
And I see it just a little differently at unemployment, and it was a priorities issue. Kind of the macro grant that we get from the federal government or from the Department of Labor, which is our employer's money, honestly, through FUTA, we get to make some decisions as to where we put those resources. We have 34 auditors, for example. The legislative auditor indicated, though minimum to modest may apply across state government, the DEED is the most focused on this. We continue to be. I see that, Senator, as our challenge internally to set priorities as to how we use the total of the money. And I agree with Commissioner Innes. We've already sent 50 files over. We have another very interesting file on appeal right now that we hope will go to the Court of Appeals that will help set some case law that will be very helpful. For our agency, the resource issue is internal, and we will deal with it and are dealing with it.
Whose major responsibility is this? Because it seems like labor and industry, this says labor and industry does not have an ongoing audit program or other means of systematically identifying. But if you kind of read what each agency does, I would think it would be their responsibility. Am I misunderstanding something?
Mr. Chairman?
Notice that we do have one agency called labor and industry that has something to do with jobs and business, and then we have another agency called Department of Economic Development Employment, which apparently has something to do with jobs and business. Do we have too many agencies?
Mr. Chairman, let me address the first part of that first. And I'm sorry that someone from DALI isn't here, and perhaps if they are and want to come up, that would be helpful. But as I understand it, they rely on private insurance companies to audit those companies that buy workers' compensation insurance from a Federated or a State Farm, whomever their insurer might be. And now I don't have to speak for them.
Identify yourself for the tape, please.
Chairman Bach, I'm Nancy Lepink. I'm General Counsel for the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry.
I missed the name. Nancy?
Lepink, L-E-P-P-I-N-K.
Thank you.
The Department of Labor and Industry's primary intersect with the misclassification of workers comes in the context of its workers' compensation, administration, and enforcement. At this point, the department does not go out and audit employers similarly to the Department of Employment and Economic Development. The primary mechanism by which the Department of Labor and Industry becomes aware of the misclassification of workers is either through a variety of situations where we receive complaints where we have an employee, an individual who's injured at work, and an issue arises as to whether or not they are an employee or not. We also have situations where we will get complaints by the public, whether it's employers, other kinds of contractors, et cetera, where they will make a complaint to the department about the potential that individuals are not being properly classified in a work situation, and then we would investigate to determine whether or not there's compliance with the state's workers' compensation statutes. The other areas, as the legislative auditor indicated, the primary enforcement responsibility of the Department of Labor and Industry is in the area of occupational safety and health compliance, workers' compensation compliance, wage and hour compliance. Our jurisdiction arises as a result of an employment relationship. Consequently, if there's a claim by someone that that they're not an employer and that everyone who's working for them is an independent contractor, and therefore they don't have to comply with any of those laws, that's where our interest arises then, is to determine whether or not, in fact, there is an employment relationship or not, and consequently, whether in this work situation there's an obligation to comply with workers' compensation, OSHA, and labor standards laws. If we find that there is, in fact, an employment relationship and that, in fact, certain people are not independent contractors but, in fact, are employees, then we take enforcement action under those various laws for the failure to comply with those laws. We don't have, and therefore, the issue of whether somebody's an employee or not arises in the context of whether there's an obligation to comply with our laws, and consequently we have jurisdiction to administer and enforce those laws. And the mechanism by which, you know, OSHA does have a planned inspection program. So they do go out and look at employers, and if in the context of that those planned inspections they discover that employees are not being properly classified, then in the context of the OSHA laws, they make the call, and then if there's a failure to comply with OSHA, appropriate citations and penalties are issued. So that's the context in which this issue of whether there's an employer-employee relationship arises. It arises for us to determine whether or not we have jurisdiction in those situations to enforce the laws that we have responsibility for.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pogama.
I think I read we have a 14% error rate, it seems like. Is that right? Wasn't there 14? Isn't that what the auditor's report says? That
Mr. Chairman.
One in seven, I think, Senator Pogama.
One in seven companies.
In the audits that are done on unemployment, one in seven companies audited has one or more employees misclassified.
Okay. So how many penalties for noncompliance have been dealt out, either administrative, civil, or criminal, by any of your agencies?
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. McGrath.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogemiller, I can get you an exact report, but we've routinely and significantly, because I get calls up when they're large numbers, imposed penalties and interest on employers who have underpaid due to misclassification. The largest one I recall was $190-some thousand. It happens routinely. Criminal penalties have not been imposed, but civil penalties and interest have been imposed and collected. I think it would be fair to say routinely.
Chairman, Senator Pogemiller, I mean, we have the same tools and mechanisms that we have in place for all tax types, so penalties and interest can be imposed. There's no, as the legislative auditor said, there's no specific penalty for chronic noncompliance or repeat offenders other than what we already have within the tax code.
Ms. Lepping, is OSHA your main compliance tool where you find, I mean, do they actually ask individuals working on a construction site, for example, who their employer is, or is that the only real mechanism you have to determine if people are misclassified?
Well, each of the, workers' compensation, wage and hour, and OSHA, the issue of whether or not someone is an employee or an independent contractor will arise in each of those contexts. So most often it arises where we go in and, in OSHA and labor standards is where we have we receive a complaint or we're conducting a programmed inspection. We go in and the hiring entity says we are not obligated to comply with your laws because all of the people here are not our employees. And consequently, we have no obligations under wage and hour, under occupational safety and health to be in compliance with those laws because those laws are triggered by an employment relationship. So then we would, if we disagree, then we are in a position of having to demonstrate that, in fact, the individuals who are exposed to the hazard or the individuals who are not being paid overtime, according to state laws, are, in fact, employees, and therefore the employer was obligated to comply with the law. So it's in the context of our labor standards unit primarily responds to complaints. OSHA has both a complaint and a programmed inspection process, but in those instances, employers are identified primarily as a result of likelihood, hazardous industries and that sort of criteria, not based on whether the department thinks they may or may not have misclassified workers. In workers' compensation, it arises in a variety of contexts, whether the issue of whether there's the misclassification of workers has occurred, and as a consequence, the hiring entity doesn't have comp. So that can come up when we receive complaints. It could come up in the context of where a worker is injured and the employer is claiming that they didn't have to have comp because this person's not really their employee. It can come up in as a result of receiving complaints by competitors, other employers. That's typically the context in which we get information regarding what there may be a misclassification of workers.
So when one of your OSHA inspectors comes onto a job site and finds out that there is no employer, everybody's independent, do they share that information with labor standards? Or is that just where it ends?
Senator Bach, I believe that if it were widespread, then there would be a sharing, probably not so much with labor standards, just because typically the labor standards in the state of Minnesota is a minimum standard, and therefore there's less likelihood that there's going to be a violation of minimum wage and overtime. However, workers' compensation, yes, there would be communication with that part of the agency as to the fact that there was a dispute as to whether or not workers were employees or not.
Senator Fogelman.
Are the rules too complex that 1 in 7 have these problems, or do people know the difference? Do employers know the difference, or are the rules too complex?
Well, Chairman, Senator, I don't know if you're directed at it.
Labor and industry, I think, because as I understand their responsibility, workers' comp, OSHA, and labor standards.
Senator Pogamiller, I think for each of the agencies, the enforcement of their laws requires an assessment of a multi-factor test to determine, or multiple criteria to determine whether or not someone is an employee or an independent contractor, and that typically those factors are applied to a case specific, and so consequently, in any given case, there could be a call made as to whether or not someone is an employee or an independent contractor. There are also some problems because Department of Revenue and the Department of Labor and Industry may not have the same test. In fact, Labor and Industry may not have the same test within the three disciplines of workers' comp, OSHA, and labor standards. And so it could be possible for an employer to argue in our OSHA program that everyone's an independent contractor, and in the work comp program that everybody is the same people are employees and conceivably be successful. So that does create, obviously, confusion between the worker and the hiring entity as to how to classify their workers. The test is 9 factors, so it can be complicated. I also think the problem is that these determinations are typically made after the fact. It's after the person is laid off. It's after the person has gotten injured at work. And so we're making this call at the end of the game and not requiring a certain education and knowledge at the beginning of hiring process.
Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner McElroy.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Pogemiller, that sequence is a little different for unemployment insurance because we are auditing proactively. We find a variance of, yes, the law is complicated, but there are employers, unfortunately, who are, quote, gaming the system, end quote, and that's where we're most likely to impose or have fairly frequently imposed penalties and interest for noncompliance. It may be different at labor and industry. I don't know their system. We occasionally find out through the appeals process where someone will file a claim and the people will say, well, you're not eligible for unemployment, you're an independent contractor. That's not as frequent as the audit. It does happen occasionally, but it's a different circumstances in stance in unemployment, and it's more at the front end, and it's found in the audit system.
Chairman, Senator Pogemiller, I mean, I can just reiterate a little what they said. I mean, we have a 9-factor test. That's a totality of the circumstances sort of test, fact-driven test. Different people can come up with a different conclusion based on the same set of facts because there is some subjectivity built into that. And then you throw in the wrinkle that we have with regard to the federal conforming, this 530 safe harbor, and you could be telling a business in one area, the unemployment insurance area, yeah, you're an independent contractor. And then another area, maybe labor and industry, no, based on the facts, the same reading of the same facts, you're not an independent contractor. So we need to do a better job of trying to maximize uniformity between the departments. And we're not there yet. This 530 safe harbor is a big impediment. And how we address that, I think, will be an important piece. Because I think the majority of it, a good chunk of it, is willful noncompliance. And I'm honestly doing this, especially in certain industries. But I also think there's a part of it that businesses are trying to do level head the best. And they're confused by the lack of uniformity between the interpretations.
Mr. McElroy.
Mr. Chairman, I hate to disagree with my good friend Commissioner Innes, but I think it more often goes the other way, where we will declare someone an employee for unemployment insurance, and then for revenue purposes, because of the 530 safe harbor, they may be found to be independent contractors. It is our recommendation that we all use the Department of Revenue test if they were exempted from the 530 safe harbor by legislation. It would give us some uniformity. We now use a test called the Common Law Employer-Employee Test. It is also multi-factor. It is just a little different. But the difference, and I agree with Commissioner Innes, there is some evidence of willful noncompliance. People will go to a meeting of the Widget Manufacturers Association and hear that their brother widget maker found a way to classify everybody as independent contractors. And rather than calling and getting advice from an agency or having an attorney give them advice, they adapt an unsound process that eventually gets them in pretty serious trouble. But the challenge is more often that we'll find them as people, as employees, and because of this IRS, I'm going to call it a glitch, you may find them as independent contractors. Revenue, rather, may find them as independent contractors.
One last thing, so I don't want to leave the impression that our efforts here are going to continue to be modest and minimal. I mean, we have not, as an agency, we have not been reticent about coming forward with ways to address this issue. I mean, the 2% withholding, I think, is a prime example. We identified an area where there's rampant noncompliance as far as independent contractor status. We've come forward for 3 or 4 consecutive years with that proposal. I know this committee has been very receptive to that. It hasn't become law yet. So this year we'll have the backup withholding proposal. So, you know, that is probably the most efficient and effective way of dealing with this issue, is expanding the scope of withholding for those areas where there's rampant noncompliance. just throwing more auditors in the field is helpful. But I think withholding and changing the laws, addressing this uniformity of definitions issue is more effective than just throwing more bodies into the audit field. And so we hope you guys can help us
Move the ball. Just as a reminder to the committee, that 2% withholding provision was in the tax bill. It was vetoed last year. And I think in addition, there were some random audits that we requested the department to do on those independent contractors that then were submitting withholding. So I expect that's going to be in this year's bill also. Commissioner, we need to talk more about the repeal of the safe harbor provision so that you and Deed are on the same page relative to this. But,
Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner McElroy.
Another development from, I believe it was 2007, was that a law was passed regarding the registration of independent contractors in the construction industry at the Department of Labor and Industry, which may serve to some extent as a pilot, and the ongoing enforcement of that provision may be useful to all of us.
Senator Squire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and probably to Commissioner Innes in the end, but it looks to me like you are trying to address some of the differences in the factors that determine whether somebody's an independent contractor or not, and part of it is the safe harbor that you're talking about. But the other thing is it appears like all of our enforcement efforts are retroactive. I mean, they just are by their nature because you're auditing what's already happened. And Commissioner Innes, do you think that this 2%, if we impose that this would be more proactive, so people would be analyzing what they're doing in the hiring process, that would be helpful?
Chairman, Senator Scully, I do. I think it's a way to get it up front and rather than retroactively, as you put it. The safe harbor issue, I think we got to be somewhat careful how we do that because there are some tests in that safe harbor that maybe make some sense. The one that really chafes me, though, is the one that says if there's a high noncompliance rate in the industry you operate in, then you get a free pass. So if everybody else is not obeying the law and misclassifying their employees, then you get a free pass. And that's the part of the safe harbor that I think maybe warrants being addressed. Some of the other ones, the tests that you can get the safe harbor say, well, if you relied on an opinion from another state agency or some of that makes sense, but the one that I think is the big loophole is if the rest of the industry is not complying with the law, you don't have to comply with the law. And I think that's the one that maybe warrants a closer look.
Well, and
Senator Squire.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Innes, well, with regard to the safe harbor provision that if you rely on information from one agency for your exemption, I mean, I can see your point there, but when the criteria are different, that's going to be a challenge then.
It is. And it's more, I didn't do it justice. It's more specific than that. It's if you were audited by the IRS and they concluded that these were, in fact, independent contractors, and then you can use that in good faith to, classify them as independent contractors. So there's a couple other tests in there that may make a little more sense than some of the other parts of the safe harbor.
Anything else, members, on the independent contractor issue? We're going to spend more time on this, I think. It is an area where I think we can pick up some revenue. Commissioner Innes, if you don't have this, maybe you can get back to me, but what percentage of your employees work predominantly in the compliance area, tax compliance?
Well, if you look at a macro, if you define compliance in a macro way, two-thirds of our budget, and I think by extension most of our FTEs, are in the compliance area. Now, that prior to this four rounds of compliance initiatives the legislature has tasked us with, we're about 50-50. 50% compliance, 50% taxpayer support, taxpayer assistance, other support functions. In the last four biennials, since we've been doing these compliance initiatives, we've transitioned to a, I would call, a hyper-compliance mode agency. So we're about two-thirds compliance, one-third support, taxpayer assistance, taxpayer information. And I think, I do want to raise a little bit of a flag on that. I think there comes a point, a tipping point, when you become so heavy on the compliance side that some of the other functions, important functions the agency suffer, like taxpayer assistance, taxpayer advocacy, and some of those areas. So I think right now we're doing a good job of meeting all the expectations the taxpayers have, but we're two-thirds, long way of saying, Senator, two-thirds compliance, one-third support.
Anything else, members? Thank you, Commissioners and Ms. Lepig. Let's move on to the Auditor's Job Z report. Mr. Yunker, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Yunker. I'm with the Legislative Auditor's Office, and I was the project manager for our evaluation of the Job Z program. I'm going to talk very briefly, just hit the high points of what our findings were in this report, then give you a little background about the program, and talk more specifically about how we reached these conclusions. What we found was that in some cases, the Job Z program has been successful in creating jobs. But we also found that there have been unnecessary and ineffective subsidies that have been provided in other cases. And we think the program needs to be focused and be more strategic in deciding which businesses should participate in the program. We also found that the administration of the program has been weak. We note that there have been some very poorly written business subsidy agreements with Job Z businesses, that there's been little oversight of those business subsidy agreements at the state level, and that Deed, who's responsible for monitoring compliance with the agreements, while they have removed some businesses from the program, they've been slow and ineffective at times in doing that. Finally, we found that the program, despite a legislative directive, has not been targeted to economically distressed areas of the state. The program is available throughout much of Greater Minnesota, and some distressed areas have not benefited much from Job Z. As you know, the primary purpose of Job Z is to stimulate or increase economic activity in Greater Minnesota, and in particular to create jobs. It tries to do this by providing tax reductions to businesses that locate in designated zones throughout the state. Another purpose of the program, as stated in the 2003 law, was to revitalize economically distressed rural areas. And what the law said on that was that the Commissioner of Deed, or Department of Employment and Economic Development, was supposed to use various need criteria or distress criteria in deciding where to locate the Job Z zones. Job Z, as I said, provides a number of different tax exemptions to qualifying businesses. They include sales tax exemptions, income tax, corporate franchise tax, and property tax reductions. Those reductions, generally speaking, with a few exceptions, extend through the year 2015. So once you're in the program, and you continue to qualify for the program and meet the requirements of your business subsidy agreements, you get these subsidies through the year 2015. The amount of tax reductions has been doubling each year of the program. It started out at about $6 million in 2004. It went to $13 million in 2005 and $26 million in 2006. So over that three-year period, the total tax reductions have been about $46 million. That amounts to about $75,000 per year per business. And as a tax committee, you may have heard an estimate last year from the Department of Revenue of about $50,000 per year per business. Because of the increase that they saw in 2006, we would say that number now is closer to $75,000 per year per business. So the costs have been growing. There's some key features of the program that are important to consider. First of all, most of the costs of the program are borne by the state. It's a tax expenditure program, and for the first 3 years of the program, 93% of the costs have been state costs, state sales tax, state income tax, franchise tax, and even a portion of the property tax is a state property tax levy. Only 7% of the costs have been local. There also is no cap on program activity. So unlike some other economic development programs, there's no budget, there's no need to set priorities. This is a tax expenditure program that's unlimited. There's no limit on the number of businesses that can participate in the program. Also, local governments have been making the key decisions in this program. Local governments are the ones who decide what businesses get to participate in the program, what the terms of their business subsidy agreements are, and those business subsidy agreements cover, you know, how many jobs the business is required to create in order to get the subsidies, how many jobs they're supposed to retain, what kind of capital investment they're supposed to make. The Department of Employment and Economic Development has taken the position that JobZ is basically a local program, something like tax increment financing. And they've provided basically little or no oversight of these key decisions that local governments have been making. One other feature of the program that's important to consider is that it's unlike perhaps any other enterprise zone or tax-free zone that you've heard of across the country. We have more than 1,150 individual subzones that are relatively small in territory and scattered throughout the state. And these subzones are movable. They're not fixed. They're not zones that businesses must move into to get the benefits. A business might indicate to a city, we want to locate here, or we would like to expand here. Can you move the JobZ territory to where we want to locate? And frequently that happens. And it requires the approval of the Department of Employment and Economic Development. But frequently it's the case that those JobZ subzones are moved to where businesses want to locate. DEED has every year reported to you and to the public on what they consider to be the effectiveness of the program. And through the end of 2006, they're saying that the program has created close to 5,500 new full-time jobs, retained about 4,500 jobs, and resulted in capital investments of about $1.3 billion. And those capital investments include not only purchases of land and buildings, but the actual construction of buildings and the installation of equipment. We think, however, that these numbers that DEED has used really overstate the impact of JobZ, and we think that for three reasons. First of all, and I'll talk a little bit about each one of these more in detail, first of all, we don't think the employment at JobZ businesses is as high as DEED says it is. Secondly, no matter what the employment at those businesses is, some of that growth would have occurred anyway. And that's substantiated by surveys of the JobZ businesses that DEED conducts. And finally, some of the businesses that have participated in JobZ have competitors in greater Minnesota. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. And those competitors are most likely adversely affected when you give subsidies to a particular business that they compete with. On this first point, we think that DEED's figures on the number of jobs that have been created are based on a flawed reporting form and process. Each year, businesses report to local governments on how many jobs they have, and what their capital investment has been, and then those local governments report to DEED. There's no certification of the accuracy of that information that's provided by the businesses. The form that's used is confusing and allows some double counting. And when we looked at unemployment insurance reports filed by the same companies, by these JobZ businesses, those reports suggest that in the aggregate, the increase in jobs at JobZ businesses has been 20 to 30% lower than DEED's numbers would indicate. So we don't think the number of jobs created at JobZ businesses has been as high as DEED reports. As I said, some of the growth that has occurred, whatever that growth has not been due to Job Z. One-fifth of the businesses that participated in the program indicated in surveys submitted to DEED and to local governments that they would have expanded to the same extent that they did in greater Minnesota, even if they hadn't gotten Job Z subsidies. In other words, these businesses, they had new customers, growing business, they were ready to expand, and in a sense, they took advantage of the program. Another 50% reported that they would have expanded to some extent in greater Minnesota without the Job Z program. Whether they would have expanded 25% of what they did, or 50% or 75%, we don't know, but some of that expansion would have occurred anyway. And I think you have to keep in mind that this is what the businesses themselves are reporting to local governments and to the state agency that's provided them with these subsidies, and I think there's some reason to suspect that there might be some bias in terms of what they're reporting, and that the actual numbers that would have expanded anyway might be higher than what the survey indicates. Only about one-fourth of the businesses responding to the survey said they would have expanded outside Minnesota had they not gotten the subsidies. I mentioned that some Job Z businesses have Minnesota competitors, and on this slide I just listed some of the businesses where it's more pretty obvious that they have competitors in the Minnesota economy that are competing for the same business with the same Minnesota customers. The program has subsidized a garbage hauler, an animal hospital, farm implement dealers, construction companies, architects' offices, wholesale distributors of plumbing and air conditioning parts, and so on. The program has not been very selective in terms of who's been allowed to participate in the program. Why is this happening? It's happening because, as I said, DEED has taken the position that it's a local program, and they've provided little or no oversight of business participation in the program. And local governments are using primarily state money to make these decisions. So it doesn't hurt for them to make a decision about allowing a business to participate in the program, even if that business has competitors elsewhere in greater Minnesota, or whether or not, or even if that business would have located in the city next to them without Job Z. It doesn't cost them much to provide the business with Job Z subsidies. These are the kind of policies that we think are needed and are absent in the current program. Currently, there is no evaluation of whether firms actually need the subsidy, whether they would have expanded without the subsidies. Secondly, there's no consideration of what the impact is on other greater Minnesota communities or other greater Minnesota businesses. Third, there's little or no analysis of the statewide benefits and costs of a particular business participating in the program. In other words, are the promised job, the jobs that a business promises, commensurate with the cost of the subsidies it's going to receive? And finally, there's little consideration of whether more limited financial assistance, Job Z is a fairly rich program with subsidies, would more limited financial assistance been enough to get the company to expand in greater Minnesota? Some local officials told us that frequently more limited financial assistance would have been enough, but the cities find it hard to turn down applications for Job Z, and they have little at stake here financially, so they tend to approve applications, particularly from businesses in their community. I mentioned that there have been administrative problems with the program as well, and I'm going to highlight problems in two areas. First of all, that there's been no DEED review of the particulars of business subsidy agreements, and secondly, that the compliance monitoring process has been slow and ineffective. Regarding the agreements, first of all, we found that some agreements have very minimal requirements in terms of the numbers of jobs that are required to be produced. Nearly half of the agreements required the company to produce five or fewer new jobs. About 40 of the 350 or so agreements required only one or no new jobs to be produced. We also found that 15 of the business subsidy agreements had no deadlines for creating jobs. In other words, a business could continue to receive tax subsidies, and there's no deadline as to when they have to create the jobs. Most of the agreements have those deadlines. However, we also found that 60 of these agreements with deadlines had no requirement to maintain the jobs created through the year 2015. So a company could create the jobs within 2 years, let's say, of the business subsidy agreement, continue to receive the subsidies through 2015, but reduce its employment after it had created the jobs, because there was no requirement to maintain those newly created jobs through the end of the Job Z period. We also found provisions in these business subsidy agreements that were inconsistent with state law, poorly worded provisions, and finally, no definition of key terms. There's no definition of what an employee is, and this kind of gets back to the misclassification of employees. Could an independent contractor be used and be called an employee for purposes of meeting the employment requirements here? Could an employee of a temp agency qualify as an employee? There's no definition in these agreements or in the program in general. Secondly, I'd point out that there's no definition of how you would calculate a full-time equivalent employee, which is often called for in these agreements, that you hire, let's say, 10 full-time equivalent employees. How do you calculate that full-time equivalent employee? And finally, there's no definition of benefits, and frequently the agreement talks about the need to meet a certain wage or benefit and benefit level. Well, how do you calculate fringe benefits? The compliance, as I mentioned before, deed has removed some businesses from the Job Z program for failure to meet the requirements in their business subsidy agreements. But it's a process that can take 1 to 2 years before noncompliance is detected. And what can happen is that some companies can receive property tax exemptions that they should not receive. And I'll give you an example of that. One Job Z business was supposed to create a certain number of jobs by the end of 2004. A building was built, but it was never occupied by the Job Z business, and they never created the jobs. And Deed did not get around to removing this business from the Job Z program until the spring of 2007. The company was able to receive the property tax exemption in both 2006 and 2007. And in this particular case, I think it's a problem with the slow compliance process. But there have been some other cases where it's not only a problem with a slow compliance process, but also a problem with the state law in particular, in that you can go back and recover 2 years of tax subsidies 2 years prior to the point that you're removed from the program, but sometimes you can continue to receive property exemptions after that point. And I think it's worth your looking at that law and perhaps changing it so that once a business is removed from the program, they can no longer receive property tax breaks. As I mentioned, this whole compliance monitoring process is based on a flawed reporting form. It doesn't require certification of accuracy by businesses. Indeed has not used the unemployment insurance information that they have at their agency to help them, to assist them in checking compliance. I don't think the unemployment insurance data is perfect. It has some problems, but it is another tool that could be used. And finally, we mentioned in the report that we think there hasn't been adequate communication from Deed to the Department of Revenue and to local property tax officials when some businesses have been removed from the program. As I mentioned, economic distress or need was supposed to be a factor in designating zones. But in the end, it really was not a factor, and here's why it wasn't. State law allowed the Commissioner of Deed back in 2003 to designate a maximum of 10 zones throughout the state. And each of those 10 zones had to be limited to 5,000 acres each, but they could include an unlimited number of subzones. So what happened was Deed and local governments got together and tried to consolidate all the requests for Job Z into these tiny subzones that I talked about, over 1,150 of them, and they consolidated all the requests into just 10 applications. Then Deed applied the need and other criteria, but when you've got 10 applications and you can approve 10 applications, the need criteria don't really matter. So need was never a factor in the designation of zones, and some economically distressed areas have not benefited much from Job Z, in particular northeastern Minnesota, the Headwaters area, and the upper Minnesota River Valley. The report has, I think, 33 recommendations in it. There are 16 for the legislature, 13 for Deed, and 4 for revenue. I'm just going to highlight some of the bigger ones, and this slide talks about some of the key legislative recommendations. First of all, we think this program needs to have some state-level oversight. We recommend that the legislature require prior approval of a business subsidy agreements by Deed before they become effective. There have been a lot of problems with those business subsidy agreements. There hasn't been a good mechanism to sort out who we should be doing, allowing to participate in the program, and this is a mechanism for doing that. Secondly, as I said, this program has an unlimited budget of sorts. There's a need to put a cap on this program in order to force the agency and local governments to set priorities and not just approve any possible subsidy agreement that comes along. We would suggest, first of all, a cap on the number of businesses that can enter the program each year. An alternative to that would be to put a cap on the estimated cost of future subsidies for businesses that enter each year. But I think the cap on the number of businesses is probably easier to administer and easier to understand. We also think that the legislature should require Deed to develop and implement criteria for participation in the program and should consider targeting the program to economically distressed areas. I'm just going to mention that there are other legislative recommendations in the report. Some of them particularly would be of concern to the tax committee. As I mentioned, there's a need to make sure that businesses that are removed from the program are not able to continue to receive property tax breaks after they're removed. There's some changes we talk about in the jobs credit that may be necessary. Consider some changes in that language, also with the capital gains exemptions. And we think there's some clarification that's needed in the Job Z statutes as well. Regarding Deed, we have a number of different recommendations. I'm going to highlight the most important ones here. The first two here really speak to the fact that we think Deed needs to play a more active role in determining which businesses participate and what is required of them in the business subsidy agreements. Deed has had a sample business subsidy agreement that's been available for cities to use. Some have chosen to use it, some have not. The agreement that they've had, I don't believe, has ever been reviewed by an attorney, and we see some problems with it. But I think what we need here is more of a standard agreement and a process for state-level oversight. The last four recommendations here speak to our concern about the compliance monitoring process. We think it needs to be streamlined and improved and based on better data. Finally, we do have some recommendations for revenue. I just bring a couple to your attention. And there was an error in the Job Z tax schedule that they have been using. We recommend changing that. I think revenue is already in the process of doing that. We think they need to revise the M500 form. The M500 form reports, has businesses that participate in the program report the sales tax exemptions that they receive. But the form is not really well designed for businesses other than Jobs E businesses, and there are businesses other than Jobs E businesses that can get these sales tax exemptions. In particular, contractors are the ones who get the exemptions, and landlords who rent to Jobs E businesses, if they have construction work done for the Jobs E business, they can get these exemptions as well. So that form needs to be revised to accommodate that. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my presentation. I'd be glad to answer any questions that the committee has.
Questions for the auditor's office? Otherwise, I'm sure there'll be questions of the department. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, that one case you said where the business built a building and never hired employees and never used the building, what did they do with it? They leased it to another business or something?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty, I believe it's being used by another business, but that business is not a qualified Jobs E business.
And, Mr. Chair, do they require that one to be paid back, the tax subsidy?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty, I'm not sure under current law you can require that to be paid back. It gets complicated, and basically it comes down to when the company was removed from the program. That company was not compliant by the end of 2004, but it wasn't removed till 2007. And then when it's removed, the agency will, the deed will say, you're removed effective, and perhaps the date is the end of 2004. The law calls for paybacks tax benefits received for 2 years prior to the time you're removed. Well, there wouldn't have been any property tax benefits in 2004. There couldn't have been, because you would have had the first property tax benefits under this program would have been in 2005. So there are no clawbacks or repayments that can be required of the company if they were removed effective the end of 2004, but then they received benefits in 2006 and 2007, which you can't touch under current law, I think.
And, Mr. Chairman, why did it take 2 years to shut it down? Just foot dragging or what?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty, I think Deed should answer that question. But there was some indication from the local that the local government involved did contact people at Deed and say that this company should be removed. And nothing was done until the spring of 2007. That was the first time that Deed did their process of doing compliance monitoring.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Pogler.
I should premise by saying that I've never liked Job C. So take that for what it's worth. But the paper of record in the Twin Cities actually supported Job C. They now say that its time has passed, it's fatally flawed. I don't know how you can do 33 tweaks and still defend the program. I mean, at some level, this is something that we should eliminate and move on. It's our job growth in the state is lagging the national averages. This clearly has not been a successful strategy. And it has all these flaws, and I say that I'm trying to be subdued on it, Mr. Chairman, because I know that there are some members of the committee that have been supportive in the past, but I'm just wondering if this isn't one of those programs that needs to be eliminated. And I say that with trepidation because I am a progressive liberal Democrat who apparently likes programs, but this is not a program that I think is one worth saving, and I would hope that our executive would see that its time has come and passed and we should look for new strategies that are successful.
Well, just to remind the committee, the Senate tax bill last year did eliminate the Jobs E program. I mean, it was starting to become pretty apparent last year that this was fraught with problems. So I guess we'll see if we can bring any meaningful change or not. And if we can't, I think, and it may be more than it may be more than we can fix. I mean, what's most troubling to me is in the statute, and I'm looking at the book, where it says the commissioner shall designate, it makes it very clear that these zones are supposed to be in economically disadvantaged areas of the state, and that's not happened. I mean, the very principle of it was that, and it just hasn't happened. And I don't know how we undo all those zones now that are clearly, we found, not in economically disadvantaged areas. I don't know how we revisit that, but I guess we'll hear from the department. Senator Langsa.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm just going to explain some things that happened in my area and my concern about if we eliminate it. Was mentioned about equipment dealers, and they had competition on the Minnesota side of the river. In Fargo, North Dakota, there were two very large dealerships. One was RDO Equipment, a John Deere equipment, and the other was Titan Equipment, which was the Case International. Now, they needed to move out of their area because they were landlocked. They could either move to another place in the Fargo, North Dakota area or into Minnesota. In both cases, they moved from North Dakota into Minnesota. Now, the RDO Equipment company owns 33 dealerships around the United States. This is now their largest dealership in the entire United States. And it's not just a dealership, it's a distributorship for their other dealers in Minnesota and in North Dakota. The Titan Equipment Company owns 36 dealerships. They came over to the Minnesota side of the river, are also making it a distributed dealership as well as a regular dealership. As far as the competitiveness is concerned, there's only one other John Deere dealership in Clay County, and that's also managed by the RDO Equipment. And the closest one for Case International is Ada, Minnesota, which is also owned by Titan. So I don't think the competitiveness in this particular area applies. And also, we're not a distressed area. So if you tighten it up too tight, then we can't match what the state of North Dakota or Iowa or Wisconsin do to help retain their businesses. I would say of the three areas have been very beneficial to is the Moorhead area, the Albert Lea area, and probably the Duluth area. And probably Duluth would be the only one that would be considered distressed. So that could eliminate the other two. And in the case of Moorhead versus Fargo, the state of North Dakota offers the sun, the moon, and the stars to get businesses to locate there. And what this did was allowed us to be competitive in that area. So I think there's obviously a lot of flaws in the job program, and I think we have to tighten it up quite a bit, but I really don't think we should throw it out, because I think in my particular area there are two very, very large dealerships with a lot of employees that absolutely would not be there on the Minnesota side of the river if we didn't have this as a tool. So I guess I would just caution you to, instead of throwing it out totally, tighten it up considerably. And I am a little concerned about saying it should only be in distressed areas. I understand the philosophy of that, but boy, if that had been the case and that had been followed real closely, there are a couple of very large businesses now located in the state of Minnesota that wouldn't be here.
Oh, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pogemiller.
Senator Langsa, to the extent they don't pay taxes, doesn't that kind of have a offsetting benefit?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Pogemiller, they don't pay taxes now. In the life of a person, 12 years is a long time. In the life of a community and a business, not a very long time.
That's fair.
Those dealerships will be there far, far beyond the time. So I think it's a matter of making some investments now, and then the business is there for maybe the next 50, 100 years.
Well, Senator Langseth, I think all the members of the committee are sensitive to some of the challenges that border cities have, specifically on our border with the Dakotas. And I think over time we've tried to be sensitive to that, but I guess we'll see what the department's response is going to be, and we'll maybe learn something. Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think many of us have some experience in our areas with Job Z. Carver County, western side, has some very serious distress economic issues. We lost an awful lot of jobs in Western Carver County in the Norwood Young America and Cologne areas over the last several years. And JobZ actually prevented an employer from taking up shop and starting a new cabinet making enterprise in the Cologne area. They were competing for that company and lost because just on the other side of the Carver County border, there was a JobZ program. And so we lost that employer because we happened to be in the 7-county metro area and we are preempted from any kind of JobZ program. So are you, there you've got a clearly identifiable distressed area that was hurt by the JobZ program. And so I think many of us kept an open mind when the governor presented it, but I'm not sure that it's lived up to the expectations. One of the reasons I wanted to step in here was to ask that if Deed comes to speak with us today about what's happened with JobZ or in the future, if they would please be willing to talk a little bit about the governor's SEED program, which sounds an awful lot like the JobZ program with a new name. It was mentioned in the State of the State address, and he is asking for the legislature to approve this strategic entrepreneurial economic development initiative, or SEED initiative, which will, quote, help new business startups and grow new jobs across greater Minnesota. Sounds familiar. I just would really like to know if there are any distinguishing characteristics and what the governor's position is with respect to the continuation of JobZ in light of his new initiative of the SEED program.
Mr. Yonker, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Very good job. Commissioners?
Thank you, John. Mr. Chairman, if Commissioner Innes could join me and we can do this together, would that be okay?
It would be helpful.
All right. First of all, I want to thank Mr. Yonkers and his colleagues and the staff of the Legislative Auditor. As they explained, this is a relatively new program. JobZ is 4 years old. I think it's interesting, when the JobZ report was released, they also released a report on Green Acres, which is 40 years old. And we're still recommending changes and improvements to Green Acres after 40 years. So I don't think it's particularly surprising that there are changes and improvements needed to JobZ after 4 years. I'd like to organize my response in along the lines of a blue sheet like this that was distributed as part of your packet. So if you have that, I think that would be helpful. Before I go down the blue sheet, you know, it isn't John's job to give you success stories. But I can't resist joining with Senator Langseth and telling you that although there are certainly some challenges with JobZ, there are also some really exciting success stories. I had occasion to ask Deed employees to check in with some JobZ employers last week. And, for example, Suzlon Wind Power chose to come to Minnesota in part because a Minnesota resident had bought some turbines from them, Dan Jewell, and got excited, went to India and met with Suzlon. They evaluated locations in Minnesota and Iowa and South Dakota, chose Pipestone, signed a JobZ agreement in the fall of 2005 that committed to 23 jobs. They built a 150,000-square-foot facility to manufacture blades. As of the middle of last week, they have 450 employees in Pipestone. They have announced an intention to hire up to 700, to have a workforce of 700 by July of this year. They asked that we not talk about the exact wage levels, but I can tell you that they are exciting for southwestern Minnesota. They are the highest industrial wages in their region, and they have excellent health insurance and other benefits. A similar occasion, a company called Daktronics expanded to Redwood Falls, Minnesota from Brookings, committed to 50 jobs in December of 2006. As of last Wednesday, had 217 employees in Redwood Falls, and they're now in 7 buildings in Redwood Falls. We're also excited about a company in Hibbing called IraCor. It's a division of another Hibbing area company that had intended to go to Montana. In fact, had announced that they were in discussions with the governor of Montana to build in northern Montana. Their product is specially lined pipe that's used for the tar sands petroleum in Alberta and Saskatchewan and now in central North Dakota. They are instead in Hibbing. They committed to 20 jobs and have exceeded that number so far. So while there are challenges, there also, I think, are good news stories. And I think Senator Langseth's example illustrates the importance of having both a strong local component, local economic development coordinators and mayors and city administrators that are heavily involved. But we have come over, and Mr. Yonkers is correct, that Deed's original view of this is that, and we think corresponding to legislative direction was, that it was largely local. We no longer agree with that. We have come to the conclusion that there needs to be a stronger state role. And if I could turn to the blue sheet, the first, we organized this in three sections, one having to do with participation in the business subsidy agreement, the second having to do with reporting and compliance, and the third having to do with some general program activity issues. In section one, number one, we would like the authority to approve deals, and we think competition is one issue. It isn't the only issue. Competition may look different in Moorhead and Clay County for these very large farm implement dealers than it may look for a garbage hauler or an animal hospital in other parts of the state. We support the recommendation we need legislative authority to have that role. Secondly, and we'd like to work with the League of Minnesota Cities, the Association of, or the Greater Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, and the Economic Development Association to craft exactly how that would work, but ultimately we think Deed needs the ability to say no. We also would like the authority to have binding criteria. We are in the process of developing some criteria that will ask questions about competition and the but-for test and scalability. But absent some change in the law, those would not be binding on local units of government. We will take action on the fact that business subsidy agreements need to have meaningful goals. We were somewhat surprised that there was any question as to what an employee is or what full-time means. We will add those definitions in an amendment. We think some legislative input on the issue of contract employees would be helpful. I think our agency position is the employees of temporary services lack permanence and probably should not count, but there may be those who will make the argument that the economic impact of somebody working for Acme Temporary and having 50 employees that may be on an employee leasing arrangement or a seasonal arrangement may be the same economic development impact on a community. I like the permanency of people being W-2 employers of the contracting company, but that's an issue that I think is worth some discussion. We also think that the issue, we were surprised to learn that there are 50-some agreements. And please understand, we don't have the authority to say no, so we probably haven't subjected these agreements to as much scrutiny as we will. But we do believe that the job commitments need to be for the life of the agreement. If somebody commits to 50 jobs, it has to be 50 jobs for the period of time they're getting the tax benefit. Number four is perhaps one of the key recommendations, and that is that we have a single mandatory agreement. We are developing an agreement. We do not have the authority, we believe, to impose that on local units of government. We think you'll hear that from local units of government, absent some change in the legislation. And number five, project cost benefits and the but-for analysis. We are going to do that work. We don't have the authority, absent legislation, to impose that, but we think it will be effective simply to be able to present that to city councils. The Jobs E process requires a public hearing. And if we provide a kind of return on investment model and it goes to public hearing, it will have an impact absent any legislation, but we could impose it if the legislature elected to give us that authority. In the second section having to do with reporting and compliance, I would like to explain that we had taken action in this area prior to the audit report, but not long enough ago, in my opinion. In November of last year, we reorganized our Business and Community Development Division and created an Office of Jobs E and Business Assistance. Bruce Strong is in the audience. Bruce, would you stand up so people can see who you are? Bruce heads that office. He joined us in November. He's a longtime commercial banker, worked at Minnesota Housing at one time. He will add focus to this. He has five professionals and some support staff whose job it is and who I can now hold accountable for making sure that the administration is both consistent and timely. We will have a new reporting form within 30 days. It will be online about 30 days thereafter. We'll create it first as a paper form. We want to get it online so that it updates the database. That will take a little time, but we're committing to do that. We do not need legislative authority. The compliance review and improved linkage to dates and subsidy agreements we can do without change. We'll work hard on that. But there's a number three will make that dramatically easier. If I had to say what's the most important report or recommendation in the report, it's section two, number three. And that's, and John rightly criticizes, although I'll disagree with one portion of his criticism, but I think he rightly criticizes the information. We report to you what's reported to us by communities and businesses. We think requiring business owners to essentially attest or certify that they're providing accurate information is incredibly important, and that I believe Commissioner Innes agrees with that, and that will be very helpful. Now, John was critical of the fact that we don't use unemployment insurance information to verify that, and we have deliberately not done that. We would have the authority to do so. Unemployment insurance information is non-public data. Even if we used it internally to verify the information, we couldn't share it with anyone, with cities or with you or with the revenue, because data practices law and federal Department of Labor regulations would prohibit that. There are also that because we don't tell employers that we're going to match their UI data to their business assistance form, they haven't reported in such a way to make that meaningful. We propose that we will require employers who enter into a business subsidy agreement to provide us the employee identification number, and we will tell them as part of the process that we will be auditing their unemployment information as it compares to the business subsidy agreement. And so it will make John's recommendation effective. We don't believe it would have been effective up to this time because we hadn't been providing that information, and we couldn't have shared the information. Fourth, a stronger penalty for local units of government. We do not have the authority to impose a fine or penalty on local units of government. Local units of government can fine businesses who fail to comply up to $1,000. I'll leave this to your judgment. Communities in general have been supportive. We do have the authority to suspend them from the program if they fail to cooperate. I think that's probably sufficient, but we understand and wouldn't object to further penalties. Fifth, we strongly support authorizing the state auditor to use confidential data, which would be unemployment insurance and tax data. We think that's a good idea. Number six, would direct us to use UI data. We intend to do that, but we need to amend the business subsidy agreement and the contract to make that effective. And we'll need, we're going to do that fairly quickly. To make it really effective would be helpful if we were authorized to do it. Seven, that we'll provide better and more timely information about jobs, e-businesses, and compliance. We'll do that as part of our compliance speed-up to the Department of Revenue and to the public, and to try to communicate much more rapidly with our zone administrators, who tend to be regional economic developers, and with sub-zone administrators that tend to be cities. And so we will follow that recommendation quickly. In Section 3 are the bigger picture recommendations, that the legislature should enact a business or dollar cap on Job-Z. We have some concerns about that. You have some experience with the one program we're aware of where there are caps like that, and that's with our use of industrial revenue bond financing. It's proved to be kind of difficult to do. You allocate the amount of federal industrial revenue bond capacity between our agency working with cities and counties, the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, and the Office of Higher Education for School Loans. There's kind of a timed trickle-down effect. We make it work, but it is cumbersome. If we do this, if we do caps, if you elect to impose caps, I think John's suggestion that we do it in the number of deals or in the number of years of applicability, we can make that work. But we hope we'll have a continued discussion on that issue. Secondly, that we should consider extending the program benefits to 10 years. Currently, the law expires in 2015, and so as the body of the report indicates, Job-Z deals being done today are for about 7 years, so they're becoming less effective. We've lost a number of transactions to other states because Job-Z doesn't have the attraction power it had earlier. In the governor's, and I would like to get to the question about SEED a little later or perhaps in a separate hearing, but in the SEED series of proposals, we suggest that Job-Z transactions be for 10 years in counties outside the metro area that have had growing populations or low unemployment, and for 12 years in counties that have had declining population or high unemployment. That's one approach to targeting. I share some of Senator Langseth's concerns about making targeting too draconian. The strategy that was used in 2003 to determine the subzones was one we thought complied with legislative intent. It was a collaborative approach where the department worked with the 10 what are now grant administrators, tend to be regional economic development agencies, to provide acres across greater Minnesota. If the legislature wishes to change that, we could do it on a county basis, as the conference committee report did last year. We think the report of having targeted non-targeted, or the approach of having targeted non-targeted to counties, may be a better approach. And then finally, I think I've covered all of those. We, in a letter that is in the back of the report, we essentially concur with three of the four recommendations. We would like to have a role, a stronger role, and would commit to partner with cities and economic developers in doing that, but we should be able to say no if things are really don't meet the job Z or the but-for test, or if they're not very smart. We have a concern about the cap, but we'll work with you if that's the judgment. Obviously work with you, and we understand the argument. We think it's perhaps the need for it would be less dramatic if we had the authority to say no to bad deals. We will tighten administration very quickly and can do that and are committed to do that. And we will work with the revenue and the counties to make the compliance much faster. The legislative auditor just shared with us this morning the name of the company where apparently because of the confusion between a status of deal never happened and deal out of compliance, the county may not have been informed promptly. We're going to go back and check every deal right now to make sure that that doesn't happen again. With that, if I could ask Commissioner Innes and then take your questions, Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner?
Yeah, Chairman, the Department of Revenue concurs with all four of the recommendations pertaining to the department. They're ones I think we've advocated for in the past. First and foremost, making the M500 form required. Right now, we strongly encourage taxpayers to file that return. They're not required under law. I think last year's bill actually had a provision in there that would require them to file the M500. The legislative auditor also correctly pointed out we had an error in our corporate tax calculation relating to Job Z. We've corrected that form. We think there's about 40 taxpayers that potentially are impacted by that. And the net result of that was it was probably understated the tax benefit they should have received. We're in the process of auditing all those. So far, we've identified none that actually were adversely impacted, but potentially there's a universe of about 40 taxpayers. So we're going through an audit process right now to make sure they get the full benefit of the corporate tax calculation. Also, we are ramping up our efforts to do a better job of communicating with the locals. And that has been, I think, an ongoing concern about this program in the last couple of years, is that when we were crafting this program with Senator Bach and others, we really calibrated the program towards the local level. We said, no, this is going to be primarily a local development tool. They're the best, most well-positioned people to make a determination about utilization of this program. They're on the ground there. They understand their community. If they want to utilize the tool, they can utilize it. In retrospect, we probably erred on the side of too much local control, not enough state oversight and hand-holding. So I think we need to recalibrate the program. I don't think anything in the legislative audit report is an inherent flaw in the program. I think that most of these can be fixed with some legislative oversight, with some greater role by DEED and the Department of Revenue. I think maybe the most important recommendation that we're going to come forward with this session is one that we'd already been working on prior to the issuance of the report, and that is requiring the business to certify their Job Z compliance. Right now, under the current program, the onus is on the local unit of government to report to the Department of Employment and Economic Development whether the business is in or out of compliance. They're just not equipped. They don't have the staff. They don't have, it's just very difficult for them to monitor.
Local unit of government?
Local unit of government,
thank you.
Correct. And so I think an important change will put the onus on the business. We've drafted very strong language that requires annual certification by the business that they're in compliance with their job creation goal, their wage goal, and their capital investment goal. It'll be a very easy form to fill out. They'll be required to fill it out December 1st, I think, of every year. If they don't certify, they will be immediately eligible for a dismissal from the program. Also, if they materially misrepresent their Job Z status, and we find that out, there also will be there'll be penalties. They could be dismissed from the program. So I think the onus needs to be on the business rather than looking at the government about confirming compliance. So I think that'll be a very, very important change. I also think it's important to keep this There certainly are flaws, and I think we can address them. But I think it's important also to have some perspective on this program. This program has been in effect, you know, 4 or 5 years. We've come back every legislative session with tweaks to the law. You know, issues that arise, unintended consequences that we didn't foresee when the program was implemented, and we've come forward to try to correct those, whether it was prohibiting retail explicitly, whether it was changing the relocation calculation to encourage more jobs and more investment for relocations. We've come back repeatedly to this legislature to address those concerns. So we know this is a work in progress, and there's more work to be done. Also, I think the legislative auditor issued 2 reports pretty much the same time, one regarding Green Acres, Senator, and one regarding the Job Z. Now, to put some perspective on this, the Job Z program is about a $25 to $30 million a year tax benefit to those qualifying businesses. The Green Acres program is $60 million a year in tax benefits. And that program has been in effect for 40 years, and now I know you guys are going to be revisiting it. But, you know, this program deserves the scrutiny. It's warranted. I think we can improve the program. But I think we should be careful about ratcheting it down too much. I agree a lot with what Senator Langsa said in respect that it wasn't just need criteria that was in the statute to take into consideration where the zones go. It was also success criteria. So some parts of the state could score very high on the need criteria, but if they didn't have the infrastructure there or the labor pool or the other things they needed to make the Job Z project work, it didn't make any sense to put acreage there. So I think there's got to be a balance between need criteria and success criteria. I think that's – we look forward to working with you on striking that balance.
Commissioner, how much of that $60 million in Green Acres is cost absorbed by the state versus – absorbed by local governments? I think that's where the difference is.
And Chairman, that's a meaningful difference. I mean, that's exclusively a property tax provision. Well, this has both the state and a local share. I will say this. I know that the legislative auditor makes a very good point about most of the skin in the game financially is within the state. In absolute terms, the state has most of the skin in the game with the tax benefits that accrue to the taxpayer. But I would say the local community has substantial skin in the game, relatively speaking. I mean, a little town like Jackson, Minnesota gives up their property tax to get an ACO to locate there. In absolute terms, most of the benefit is still coming from the state, but in relative terms, that's a real sacrifice for that community. And it was, for them, they made a determination that was worth it. So I think the state definitely has a skin in the game. I think we also has got to be an important local component to this. They still have, you know, substantial dollars at stake in this program.
Many members?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Senjum.
Maybe just to chime in, I served on a city council for 11 years, and we would have businesses approaching us. Want to locate in Minnesota, want to locate in Rochester, but we've got Cedar Rapids, we've got Sioux Falls, we've got Minot, we've got Moline, Illinois, and we've got all kinds of choices. And many of these states had if you will, some business subsidies for them that they could offer, and they would come, they would come to our city, and we could offer them a little tax increment financing and a lot of love, and very often that a lot of love wasn't enough, nor was the TIF. And so, as at least I look at this, I'm looking at a program. It may not be perfect, but for goodness sakes, it's the kind of program that I think allows local governments in Minnesota to compete with other states and compete for businesses that frankly want to be here, because in some cases they want to be next door to another business which complements it. So I would just simply urge we not be too hasty on this, and that we give it a long look before we certainly abolish it, and hopefully if it needs some fixing we do that, but at least keep some opportunities for Minnesota communities to compete in a multi-state arena for our share of the businesses.
Commissioner McElroy, is the department going to come forward with a bill, a Job Z, that addresses the auditor's concerns?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzen's committee held a hearing on this yesterday and asked us to work with John Fuller from his staff, Senator Rosen and Senator Spark, to develop a bill that would go first to their committee and then come here. And our staff began work with Mr. Fuller, I hope, late yesterday or this morning. And, yes, we are working on bill language, and I believe it's the intention of Senator Rosen to introduce that as a bill, if that's workable with you.
I think it would be helpful if we had a bill in front of us that we then could critique. Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I was just going to a quick reaction. What Senator Senjum just said, if it were true, that would be great. But I think the auditor's report shows us that we don't know if those statements were true or not. And I just wonder, and I've wondered for a long time, and I was on your job, C. Bill, when it was first enacted. So I just wonder if Job Z isn't just such a scattershot, broad brush, unfocused substitute for what I think we really lack in our state, which is a fairly targeted, fairly well-conceived, coherent overarching economic development strategy that first starts with what are those industries that we have in the state that we can bolster, that we can enhance, take better advantage of. What are the emerging industries that we want to go after and really create some focus around that, and then array our policies and our financing and our priorities around that strategy, like other states have done. I just don't see that Minnesota's doing that. That's the workforce needs, the supporting infrastructure. What are the associated industries, services, businesses that would support those main thrusts? What are we doing in our higher ed institutions in the way of research? We've got some stuff going on here and there. We hear a lot about biosciences and this and that and the other, and Minsk is off doing its thing, and then we've got something going on over here, but I just don't see that coherent framework that ties it all together. Whether or not we're even going to pass a transportation bill is a big question. That's a ridiculous question to have. We should know that we're going to be passing a transportation bill that provides that essential infrastructure we need to support the emerging economy. So that's what I'm sitting here thinking about, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman,
Commissioner McElroy.
If I could respond. Senator Dibble, I'd like to make an appointment to come into your office and talk about this in more length. But you raise a good point. We are heavily involved in the issues that you raise that are called kind of in the industry's sector strategy and cluster strategy. We recently, using federal Workforce Investment Act money, created a series of grants called FIRST Grants, Framework for Integrative Regional Strategies, and 10 of those have been issued, or 11 actually now around the state. I'm sorry, stand corrected, 9, including one in the metro area that's being administered by the Twin West Chamber of Commerce with a partnership with the Hennepin County Workforce Investment Board and others to address the very issue that you're talking about a more collaborative strategy between K-12 education, higher education, workforce development, traditional economic development. We would argue that Job Z is one tool in an economic developer's toolbox. And it gets to Senator Ortman's question about SEED. SEED is some additional tools that involve working with entrepreneurs through our small business development corporations, with small business innovative research, with some entrepreneur programs through the workforce centers and a variety of others. And again, let us make an appointment to come and tell you more about all of the SEED tools. It has 3 strategies and 22 initiatives. Job Z is just one tool in both of those areas. Clusters, and Minnesota is probably a little ahead. We were chosen for a national academy on cluster and sector strategy. We have a lot of work left to do on that, and it will be a long-term program. But early in being commissioner, somebody from one of the initiative foundations walked up to me and did one of these kind of finger-in-the-chest numbers and said, "What's your comprehensive economic development strategy for Minnesota?" And I said, I think it makes more sense to have regional strategies because Minnesota's economy is so diverse. So there may be a different strategy as a metropolitan integrative strategy, a different strategy in northeastern or northwestern or west central Minnesota. But you're right, Job Z is only one, I would argue, small but important component of a more integrative strategy, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Well, I heard Governor once say that Job Z was the mother of all economic development efforts. We're losing jobs. We're losing jobs ahead of pace with the rest of the country. Minnesota used to outperform the rest of the country and never quite dipped as low as the rest of the country in a downturn because we did this at one time, whether regional, which I agree with you, Commissioner, that, we don't have an industry that covers it. We have different facets in different parts of the state. And we're slipping. We're not the kind of state we used to be that outperformed its neighbors and outperformed the rest of the country. And so I'm glad conversations are being held about this, but I don't see the outcomes right now.
Senator Dibble, I share your concern about the lack of personal income growth in this state. And, you know, if we're not growing personal income, we're not growing revenue. And, you know, I mean, we've got schools that are hungry for some additional funding. We've got problems in our higher ed institutions with rising tuition. I mean, you can tick off the list. Senator Scoy has mentioned more than once the challenges to maintain our nursing homes. And if we're not growing revenue through increased personal income, I think we need to very seriously examine what's changed in Minnesota, that why are we not growing personal income anymore, and try to get our arms around that. I have to believe it's important to everybody in this room. And I'm also very concerned. I mean, I never thought I would ever – I think didn't state economists say we actually have had negative job growth in the last 12 months? Less people working in Minnesota today than 12 months ago. Something clearly is amiss right now. And I think it's very hard to deny that something isn't wrong. And we all need to collectively, I think, start to think about where – is there a fork in the road we've taken that's creating this, or is it something out of our control? Commissioner McElroy.
Mr. Chairman, that's accurate. We had those numbers come from the labor market analysts that work at the Department of Employment and Economic Development. And Bob Isaacson, who runs that unit, is in the audience. And if you want to take the time, we can go into more detail. Year-over-year employment was down by about 300 jobs. A typical year is that we gain – we've had years where we've gained up to 70,000 jobs. A gain in the 20,000 to 30,000 would be more normal. We have expressed the concern that one of the reasons Minnesota's economy is trailing the national job production economy fairly dramatically is an overexposure to industries that are heavily impacted by the downturn in residential construction. We have, I believe, 7 oriented strand board and plywood manufacturing companies in northern Minnesota, and there, I believe, only one or perhaps two of them are operating currently. We have significant employers that make things like paint and doors and windows and a wide range of kitchen cabinets. It's a fairly big industry. They have been rather heavily impacted, dramatically impacted. We also have one of the largest mortgage finance and mortgage servicing segments in the country with companies like GMAC Residential Funding, Wells Fargo Mortgage, and Bell Mortgage. They have been negatively impacted. Two of the industries that traditionally make up for downturns in other industries have been medical devices and auto manufacturing. Although Ford isn't doing terribly well, they're up a little bit right now because of Canadian exports of the Ranger. Haven't been available to offset things the way they used to, nor have medical devices. We share some of your concerns. Senator, if you'd like a more in-depth, we've created a little working group that includes economists from the Department of Revenue, the Department of Finance, the Department of Economic Development. I'd be happy to arrange for Mr. Isaacson or Mr. Stinson to make a presentation on the job trends outlook to the Tax Committee, if that would be convenient.
Well, Commissioner, I don't think this is going to turn around on its own. I mean, I do think the state is going to have to provide some kind of a stimulus to this economy, and I hope it's enough. But I'm just not sure it's going to turn around. I mean, the global marketplace is changing.
Yes.
And I'm very concerned that we make some effort to get our arms around what Senator Dibble expressed. Where are our strengths? Where we can focus some attention. Senator Ortman.
Senator
Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And as part of the conversation, we can't forget that we're losing major corporations over the last couple years, major employers, and now Macy's. So,
Mr. Chair.
Part of the conversation.
Senator Scoy.
Well, Mr. Chair, I wasn't going to throw my 2 cents into this, but Commissioner Itis mentioned AGCO, and I vaguely remember when the CEO of AGCO was coming into Minnesota, they were talking to him about what was in Minnesota that he was being recruited for. And it was a vibrant community with good services and a good school. It didn't really have anything to do with the taxes that they were going to pay. And, And I know that the CEO of Polaris, I heard it with my own ears, when they were trying to recruit engineers up into Roseau, the most challenging thing that he was facing was demonstrating a vibrant community, a vibrant downtown after the flood, and how we were going to address that, and a good, vibrant school system. Now, the state certainly has a role to play in the vibrant school system that has been shifted onto the property tax. And so we need to look at that. But when we're looking at jobs and job development and these economic development tools, we have to keep in mind what CEOs are asking for. And if I recall, a couple of years ago, we had testimony from, I think it was Minnesota Justice or one of those groups, that the vibrant community and the quality of the schools is at the top of the list. And really, down toward the bottom was the property tax burden that they were facing. And so we need to balance that as we're looking at this job development and economic development in Minnesota. And, you know, I think it's shifted the wrong way. Our schools aren't as strong and as vibrant as they were a decade ago.
Senator Skoy, at the annual chamber dinner a week ago, I sat with a very, very large international company that has a very strong presence in Minnesota. And I was sitting next to the COO, the second guy in charge. And when the governor got done with his speech, he leaned over to me and I was sitting next to him. He said nothing about workforce. And I didn't go to the governor's state of the state, but the feedback I got was there was nothing about workforce development. And I think there is growing concern in the business community that, you know, as a lot of baby boomers sitting around this table, we're moving through the employment door here. I think there is growing concern in the business community about where this next generation of workers is going to come from, and is the state going to invest in them like we did in the previous one to keep them productive? You know, I've heard the governor say we're not going to make widgets anymore. We're going to grow this economy because of productivity, and productivity growth requires workforce development. We're not going to grow productivity through tax policy. We're going to go through our workforce. And I think we need to keep that in mind, that we've got a huge, huge bubble of people moving through our workforce. And I'm not sure that in today's environment in Minnesota government, we're very well prepared for that, to make sure that our business community is going to be competitive and the next generation of employees are going to be prepared to the degree I think they need to be. Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, I do think that our tax policy in the state of Minnesota is going to have an impact or an effect on our economy going forward. I think that's a great responsibility for the members of this committee. I feel it as a very important part of my work here to make sure that our tax policy is as sound as possible to promote economic growth and not further the negative impacts of what's been happening. I look at our tax policy and I see an awful lot of tax credits, people who don't pay full load in the state of Minnesota, and I see an awful lot of tax spending where we take the money that we raise and put it into programs like JobZ and this potential seed program. And I think that we should be looking for performance on these programs, that these dollars are vital to our economy. They are extremely expensive on the part of the taxpayer. They are a significant burden for those people that actually pay the taxes that then get put into another tax credit program. We need to keep an eye on all of these tax credits and say, where is all this money going? And are we sure that we have performing models? And the JobZ program, in my view, is not a performing model. It hasn't had the impact that we hoped it would have. And so now we should take a giant step back and say, looking at the whole tax policy and tax structure, and say, where are we spending our money, and could we lighten the load, the burden, on the current taxpayers in the system? And I would hope that this committee will take that big view.
Well, Senator Ortman, I think we're going to we're going to spend an extended period of time on the department's tax expenditure report. I'll put it all on the table there for you. Senator Cohen has asked me to find $150 to $175 million in cuts that this committee can make to help balance the budget. And that is going to be, I think that's very difficult to do if we just look at aids and credits, which is where we spend our money. I think we've got to dig deeper into tax policy and take a look at if some of the tax expenditures we have really are connected to anything and have any are giving us much, because they've been done in a very piecemeal basis over the years. So, Senator Ortman, I look forward to the conversation we're going to have reviewing tax expenditures and seeing if really some of them have the value that at the time when they were passed we thought that they brought, because it's very easy to do tax expenditures when there's money around, and it's going to be difficult to now review them and take a look at whether they all make sense. Senator Ortman?
Mr. Chair, I would say that also we should be looking to see that what was a priority, evaluate it to ask ourselves, is it still a priority for us to invest or incent this program? Priorities change with the economy, I would think, and values change over time, and so I think we should look at it with that critical eye as well. But I also hope that we can, as a committee, look at what Commissioner McElroy has offered, which would be a study of the job trends in the different sectors of the economy, because we have lost manufacturing jobs, and manufacturing jobs, at least in my view, over time are probably the best investment. And so we should be looking at which ones are the ones that help us survive these economic downturns and upturns, which ones are the steady ones, as opposed to like the real estate market. I know they helped us quite a bit in difficult times in the last recession. The real estate and home builders really pulled us out in 2003 and 2004 when things were tough, but we should look at those long-term trends to say where should we be focusing our efforts, and I hope that we will do that soon, Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Linus, when were we going to have the tax expenditure?
We should have it, Chairman. Chair, I think it came out a couple weeks ago, 10 days ago. It's a draft to you, tax expenditure document. 250 pages of great information. I'm looking forward to going over with you guys.
Yes. Staff tells me we got it on Thursday or Friday last week. So okay. We'll get a copy distributed to all the committee members. And if you could spend some time on that, I think it would be very helpful. Senator Cohen has given us a pretty big challenge. We all know that the level of property tax increases, I think it's fair to say statewide, are running ahead of inflation, and property taxes are becoming more and more problematic, especially the reliance of schools to have to go to the property tax. So in figuring out how this committee can make some budget cuts, I'd like to avoid things that turn into property tax increases that further exacerbate that problem. So I think the tax expenditure report is probably the best place for us to start in looking for cuts. So we'll make sure all the committee members have a copy long before we take it up here, so that we had a chance to review it, so we'll have some good questions for the department when we get to it.
Chairman?
Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Innes.
Yeah, just a real quick, we look forward to the tax expenditure report discussion, fully vetting that document. There's a lot of things that haven't been revisited in a number of years. I think it's always a worthwhile exercise to look at the tax expenditure document. And I concur with what Senator Scully said and the chairman said. Labor force is always the number one thing the businesses say what they need. They need a robust labor pool. They need skilled labor force. But I will say taxes always come up in the conversation, and taxes matter. Taxes are relevant. And it may not be the first thing on the list they mention. It's usually, skilled labor force. Can you provide me with a skilled labor force? They check the box there, and the discussion without fail goes to tax climate and expense of doing business in the state of Minnesota. So I don't want to, overemphasize the tax environment, but it is relevant to job creators.
And, Commissioner, every one of those tax expenditures have some constituency group. Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, the goal that Senator Cohen has for our committee, $150 to $175 million, to what end, if I may ask? What's the overall, what's the point, and what's driving that number?
The budget forecast is what's driving that. Senator Cohen, a month ago, had asked me if I could look for about $80 million in cuts, and then the Finance Committee would have found the other $300 million to balance the budget when we were looking at a $373 million deficit. I haven't met with the Council of Economic Advisors, but Senator Cohen sat in on the most recent meeting, and most people are speculating that the deficit's going to grow significantly on the 28th of February. And I think his suggestion to basically double the amount of money that he'd like us to find, I think indicates his feeling that the deficit's likely to be significantly more than 373. Nothing magical about the 150, the 175. Tax committees have seldom shared in the budget cutting process, but I do think we could make the legislature's job much easier if we reviewed some of our tax expenditures and see if they all still make sense. Senator Hartman.
Mr. Chair, I agree with Senator Cohen. I think that it's going to be a greater deficit than 373 by a significant amount. And I hate to say that because, you know, you hate to be a naysayer or a negative, but I've seen the same impacts that he has and that the council has seen in our communities. But in the meantime, to just come up with a number of tax expenditure cuts in this committee would seem to be part of an overall picture that hasn't been disclosed to me. And that's what I'm getting at. I'd like to know if there's some goal somewhere on the part of the Senate leadership. I'd sure like to know what it is, if they think that this is part of a bigger package of tax increases, which is what I fear. I'd like to know that. I'd like to know to what end. If Senator Cohen's asking us to help, what's the overall goal? And to the extent you have that information, I hope you'll share it with
this
committee.
Well, I think what Senator Cohen asked all of his finance divisions to do was to find 3% cuts in their budget. And if you look at the aids and credits that the tax committee spends, it's about $3 billion for the biennium. A 3% cut in our expenditures would be about $90 million. And that goes forward, that corresponds with what he asked his divisions to do already a couple of months ago. So when he talked to me about 80, I think that was in line with a 3% reduction, which is what he was asking all of his divisions to do. Now, I'll say it again. The tax committee has seldom, if ever, participated in the budget cutting process. And I did remind Senator Cohen that, you know, it was pretty widely reported last year that there was a $2 billion surplus. And, you know, you could argue about whether how much of that was one time and how much of it was ongoing. But I did remind him that the Finance Committee spent all that money. That the Tax Committee did not spend one dime last year. Not a dime. So we could easily take a 3% cut on what we spent in this biennium, because we have spent zero. And so really, we're looking at cutting out of the 06-07 budget base, because we didn't increase it in 8 and 9. But that's what they've asked us to do, and I don't know if we can accomplish that. We'll look through the tax expenditures and see if we can accomplish any of that, but I did commit to him that we will, as a committee, try to make an effort to find some places we can cut some money. And, you know, a year from now, by all appearances, this job's going to get a lot tougher. The 10-11 budget's going to be a real challenge. So anything we can do this year, keeping that in mind, is going to make our job much easier next year here when we're trying to put the next biennial budget together. So some scrutiny, I think, will make our job easier a year from now. Commissioners, anything further?
No, Chairman.
Anything else from the committee members? When are we meeting again?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sundrum.
No sense to belabor this meeting with, but, you know, I think, you know, we had the start of, I think, some pretty good discussion about business climate and job growth and job creation. I just think we need to continue to do that, and I'm sure we will.
Thank you. Members, we are meeting again tomorrow morning, same time, 8:30, and we will have the omnibus transportation bill in front of us for our consideration. Meeting adjourned. If you could, maybe sometime today or tomorrow, staff tells me that some of our committee folders are getting pretty full of stuff you previously had saved. If you can go through there and take a look if there's some stuff from last year. We didn't throw anything away. So if there's some stuff from last year that you don't need anymore, it would be helpful if you would take it out of your folder so that we can start to save some new things for this year. Committee adjourned.